Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. I hope you've had a chance to visit it. If you haven't had a chance, I hope you will. And it's been there forever, but it hasn't always been a national lakeshore. How did that happen? Who are the people involved? One of the people involved was Bud Jordahl. He is one of the authors of the book. He's passed away now. A wonderful man. And it's kind of his story. And the title of the book is Environmental Politics and the Creation of a Dream, Establishing the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. The other author is Annie Booth. She's the co-author. She's an associate professor in the Ecosystem Science and Management Programs at the University of Northern British Columbia. She's with us by phone. Annie, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
I really appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, Steve Bourne with me in the studio. Steve's been a guest many times, a good friend and colleague of Bud Jordahl's, professor of environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a professor emeritus now. And Steve, it's great to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry.
Wow. I tell you, there's so much that we could talk about here, Annie, but let's go back to the designation. Where did the idea of the Apostle Islands having a national designation come from?
Well, I think that was really out of a discussion between Gaylord Nelson, who had been the governor of Wisconsin and had spent quite a lot of time in the area, and people like Bud Jordahl, who was one of his crew cut boys in the 50s and 60s. That's honestly what they called themselves. And this is an area that is very, very special. If anybody's ever been to the Apostle Islands or to that region, it's pretty significant. It's beautiful. It is a very particular and unique ecosystem. But as anybody who's looked at the history of it knows, from the 1860s on, this is a pretty heavily devastated region. It had been the source of a lot of natural resources that had been exported, and the area was so badly devastated that in the 1930s, when there was some local interest in establishing a national park in the area, they were actually turned down by the National Park Service, who said it's just too trashed. This is not national park quality. You guys have really done a number on this area. So we know the area was not protected, and it took a ecological and aesthetic beating as a consequence. Now, over that time, of course, during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it grew up again to what we think of as ecologically and aesthetically quite spectacular. But I think at the back of the minds of the people in Wisconsin, like Gaylord and like Bud Jordahl, there was a real keen awareness that if you didn't protect that ecosystem, it could easily be destroyed again, as it had before. And so, in addition, there was some interest in really generating some economic potential. That's a very economically depressed region in the 50s and 60s. I think it still struggles a little bit today.
Yeah.
And the idea of a national park that would bring in visitors, that would bring in dollars, that would perhaps create some employment was pretty critical to the political leaders of the day, and quite validly so. But one of the other genesises of the idea really came out of the indigenous people, the Bad River and the Red Cliff Chippewa, who had come into the area in the 1400s and had been put on reservations in the area. And the Bad River Chippewa, who are up near Ashland, were really concerned about increasing and appropriate uses of the Bad River sloughs, which are a very critical area for them, both for hunting and trapping,
yes,
but also spiritually and culturally. And they wanted to really see some protection. And at the time, there was some interest among other indigenous peoples in the lower 48 in utilizing national parks and other parks cooperatively as a way of trying to establish some protection in an area where they didn't have really any much rights, because it was outside the reservation area. And so, indeed, the first real legal impetus to get this park started was a request out of the Bad River Tribal Council to start to investigate. And that was the real spark that Gaylord and Bud and the Hansen brothers, Martin and Lewis Hansen, who were very deeply involved in it, to really start moving ahead on a national park proposal. And that was back in the very early 60s. And, you know, the fact that it took until 1972 to get established just tells you how long politics can take, even for a really good idea. But that was the real emphasis is let's protect an area that has been damaged but has managed to recover and is pretty critical to that particular ecosystem.
And I think Bud and you were interested in not only telling that story, but also providing a book that would give some insights into others who may be interested in this sort of thing.
Yes, that's correct. You know, as Steve will tell you, this wasn't the only thing Bud was responsible for helping to establish in Wisconsin or elsewhere, but it was a pretty big one. One of the things that Bud wanted to do was just to tell the story of a national park, because the people often go to places without really understanding what went into their creation. And that's pretty important, particularly in modern times, to understand political process. You know, as Ben Franklin said, it's like sausage making. It's pretty ugly to see,
yeah. But
people only see the result. But if you want to protect natural resources, if you want to protect the environment, a lot of times you do have to get involved in political decisions. And I think Bud really wanted to tell that story so people would understand both how difficult it was, both what the challenges were, how much political compromise was involved in it, how many times things out of the blue that they didn't anticipate almost derailed the process, but also just, you know, what a group of really dedicated individuals can do if they really stick with the program. And I think, immodestly speaking, as a co-author, I think that's what the book manages to do, is really give a sense of how important it is to commit yourself.
Yes, I would agree with that. And how did you happen to come to work with Bud on this? What's your connection with Wisconsin?
I did my PhD at the Institute of Environmental Studies. I wandered back and forth across the border in my life many times. And in my third year, I think it was, I picked up a summer job working for Bud, actually on doing some background work for a congressional proposal to put the Visitors Center in at the Apostle Islands. And so Bud and I guess, clicked, and he became a member of my PhD committee. And after I managed to graduate and pick up a job, he came back and said, well, I'd really like to take this report and turn it into a book. Would you be willing to work with me on it? And, you know, you don't get offers like that every day.
No, no, you don't. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Bud. Steve, you are good friends with Bud and colleagues. Can you share some of your memories of Bud and his life's work?
Let me say a couple things by way of preface, Larry. Annie and Bud, and Annie did a marvelous job working with Bud because Bud was meticulous in detailing these things. And this manuscript had been sitting around about 800 pages or so with every detail in place. And Bud was unwilling to be the ruthless editor and remove any of it. And I think Annie worked with him and the UW Press to really produce a significant book that chronicles not only this case, but it's applicable to other cases, as Annie said. Secondly, I think it's interesting to talk about some of the personalities. They were crew cut guys, although some of them are losing their hair at this point in time. But there were the Titans of the North in terms of conservationists, not just the Hansons. Martin Hansen, a great conservation activist, Chuck Stoddard, who had been head of the Bureau of Land Management, but spread around the northern part of the country. And it was Gaylord who convinced Kennedy to take this conservation tour, which would include right after he was elected, to take a conservation tour, which included the Apostle Islands. And these guys, sitting up in the Hansen compound near Mellon, conjured up the set of tactics and what would make this a very special visit for the president. So when they did the overflight Martin Hansen was serving as tour guide, but they'd arranged to have a lot of the wonderful sailing boats out there, and that caught the president's attention. It wasn't Hyannisport, but it looked pretty good out there in the Bayfield area. So these guys were very, very good at selling the idea as well as conjuring up and doing the important background work. Bud himself, it's a story that could be a very long show, but an amazing guy in so many different ways. He got a forestry degree in 1950, and his first job was in Viroqua as a district game manager, and that really began his love affair with the Coulee country, with southwestern Wisconsin. There's a family farm outside Richland Center, which has been the site of just innumerable habitat management efforts, environmental restorations, and once in a while, these guys were lucky enough to harvest a deer or a turkey, but I don't think the economics of that activity were particularly great. He worked in state government and was moving up through the ranks of what was the precursor of the now DNR. In the mid-1960s, he went over to Harvard and took a master's degree with John Kenneth Galbraith and some other luminaries, and it was a shaping factor in his life. When he returned, he continued to work in state government, but then moved in the early 60s to working with Stuart Udall's Department of Interior as the regional coordinator. And at that point, Gaylord had moved on, had become a U.S. senator, and it's that period from about 64 to 68 where Bud worked most closely with Nelson in doing a lot of the background intellectual work that put the underpinnings in place, not only for the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, but for the National Wild and Scenic River Program.
Oh, excellent. David in Lakota Ray has a question or comment. By the way, if you'd like to join in, you are certainly welcome as we talk about the Apostle Islands and the National Lakeshore. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Now we'll turn to David. Thank you for waiting, David.
Oh, no problem.
What's on your mind?
Well, great political comments today on political history. What I wanted to add was the significant cultural and tribal importance of the Apostle Islands to the Lake Superior Ojibwe. Back in the day, predating 1400 or so, the Apostle Islands was one of the final resting stops on the Ojibwe migration from the east. So it has significant cultural and traditional importance. And I just wanted to
bring that in.
Listeners be aware of that.
Yeah, and Annie, I know the first part of your book is sort of a history.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and comment.
No, he's utterly correct. It's a very crucial area for the Ojibwe, both in terms of just being able to make a living. There's still quite a lot of active people on the land, but it is really a significant cultural and spiritual site. We talk a little bit about that in the book, but I kind of hesitate to comment on it. But you talk to people up there, you know, people like Joe Rose and people who are very powerful spiritual people up there, and that's a really critical area for that particular culture. And for very good reason. That wasn't always recognized or respected over the 50s and 60s. And one of the things that happened to the Apostle Islands proposal was that it got caught up in the politics of the 1960s and the Red Power movement. I think in part that was just, you know, an accident of history, but I also think in part that it became a bit of a lodestone for protests, which literally almost got the proposal kicked out of consideration in Congress, in part because the indigenous people of the area felt so strongly about that particular area and were willing to go to Washington to talk about its significance and some of the injustices they had felt about it. So that's a very critical area, and too often we tend to forget about indigenous histories in areas that go back considerably longer than European arrivals. And insofar as we were able to reflect that. Now, there are some disagreements. There are a couple of articles and books out there that argue that the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore wasn't of benefit to the indigenous peoples of the region. I don't take an opinion one way or the other on it because I think it's all a matter of interpretation and setback in the
in the times. I do know there is some interest on the part of the National Lakeshore to work with the indigenous peoples. Whether it's successful from their perspective, that's something you would have to discuss with them.
Mm. Annie Booth is co-author of Environmental Politics and the Creation of a Dream, Establishing the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. She's an associate professor in ecosystem science, managing and the management program at the University of Northern British Columbia. Steve Bourne, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we talk about the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Had the lakeshore been as large as some of its proponents wanted, it would have looked a little different than it actually wound up looking. Is that not correct, Annie?
Yes, there were several iterations of the lakeshore that were proposed. Many of them were the original ones were really quite extensive, and included lands that bordered into and included some of the alienated reservation land at Red Cliff and Bad River. It also included plans for a scenic highway that would have brought tourists through some of the smaller towns, and it actually did include some of the smaller communities like Hebster, kind of along the lines of the Cape Cod idea, where towns would be in part of the lakeshore and would be part of the attraction for people to go through. I think that's one of the lessons that the book offers, is that you can start out with some very grandiose plans and ideas with the best of all possible intentions. They really wanted a contiguous, coherent land base. They wanted to assist in repatriating some of the alienated reservation land, and this is one way that they thought they could go about doing it. And they wanted to give some of the communities a real stake in the national lakeshore by including them. It ran into massive political opposition for a number of different reasons. The indigenous peoples, of course, as I mentioned, actually turned against the lakeshore in significant ways, due in part to involvement in the Red Power movement and outside interests getting involved. But a lot of the local communities also had very mixed feelings about it. One of the things that had happened over the years is a lot of what became the lakeshore, many of the islands had private residences on them. People had bought the land. Some of it was farms that had simply become resorts. There were some fairly big names and a lot of big money sitting in that land, and having a long-standing, you know, third-generation stake in maintaining those lands. And a lot of them were able to whip up quite a lot of opposition to takings of the land for the purposes of a national park. And so a lot of communities chose to opt out. A lot of communities actually wanted payment to participate, which at the time the National Park Service and Congress wouldn't authorize. There was some real questions about how much economic development the park would bring in. There was a lot of questioning of the actual dollar figure that was proposed by the planners of the park. And things got really, really convoluted in the negotiations. And in the end, the thing that really caused the boundaries to retract, and retract quite considerably, was the opposition of Bad River and Red Cliff. Congress would not impose it on them. The tribal councils were not willing to sign off on it. And I think Gaylord and Bud and Udall were quite correct in finally biting the bullet on that one. And you either want a park, however reduced, or you don't get a park at all. So they bit the bullet on that one and reduced the boundaries accordingly. And, you know, that's just...
That's how it went. Steve, you had a comment.
Well, let me
put it in a little bit bigger context. There's a lot of different ways of accomplishing bigger and broader, larger scale objectives. Bud was working for the Department of Interior as the representative for the entire region. In the mid-1960s, President Johnson appointed him to be co-chairman of the Upper Great Lakes Regional Commission, which was an economic development commission. And he was always interested in how the resource base and the environmental attractions of our Upper Great Lakes area could aid the economy and at the same time provide the kind of protection and stewardship of those resources into the future. And so his view was, while there might be contraction, I think, of an individual park and losses along the way, he always was looking at a network of star attractions in the Upper Great Lakes area. Some of it came to life with the creation of the Great Lakes Visitor Center up in Ashland, in which he wanted to commit to his lifelong interest in outreach and citizen education and showing the public the tremendous array of resources we had across the Great Lakes area. It also shows up, for example, in proposals. Bud was very, very intimately involved with the creation of the Wisconsin Riverway. But his proposal, as one of the architects with Gaylord of a national wild and scenic river system, was to federalize that thing. It was opposed by the state. Bud proved to be, over a period of years of negotiation, very adaptive. The state was going to create the Riverway Board without what they viewed as some of the federal hamstrings and dictates and so forth. And Bud shifted gears and became a citizen activist with the citizens group there for the lower Wisconsin. And over a period of time, we now have this wonderful Wisconsin Riverway. It's not a federal piece of work, but we essentially accomplished the same thing. And in fact, it was quite fitting that the DNR board has just designated a unit of the Wisconsin Riverway in Bud's name.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve in Colfax has a comment or question. Mm-hmm. Steve, hello to you.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Fascinating discussion. I've got a feeling that my comment may be, or question may be, a little bit off the mark here. There's a proposal for a taconite mine in Iron and Ashland counties that is drawing a lot of heat in terms of the rapidity or the speed with which the permitting process may be approved. And it hasn't been very many years since Miles Lord got the reserve mining to quit dumping taconite into the lake on the Minnesota side. Folks in Ashland and Bayfield and the Bad River and Red Cliff area are concerned about this. I sail out of Ashland myself, and I know how clean that water is. I'm concerned about it. Are you folks familiar with it?
You know, this really kind of goes along with something that I think Bud said. And by the way, the book is kind of in the first person, so you're hearing it in Bud's voice. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the fact that the Apostle Islands and the lakeshore themselves aren't going to be hurt so bad as the things that happen outside, immediately outside, and even further away, the effects of those things. I think that's how it was put in the book, Annie.
Yeah, that's correct. One of the problems with national parks or any sort of reserve is they are exceedingly vulnerable to outside activities. Anything that affects the Great Lake, and that ranges from everything from improper mining with poor reclamation to the possibility of waters warming and receding due to global climate change, have the potential to really affect any national park. And Lake Superior is very vulnerable to a number of things, and therefore the Apostle Islands is very vulnerable to those sorts of things. So. But it's really often very difficult, and I live in a country where the environmental assessment process is a little iffy itself right now. It's often difficult to get those broader scale issues to be considered. Are they going to consider what happens to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore if they do put a taconite mine in? I don't know. I do know the last time I was up there standing on in Lake Superior, which is always a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
You can walk out there and just pick up taconite balls that roll around. I've got a couple back home that I picked out of Lake Superior. There's already taconite in that lake.
Well, let me try to specifically respond to Steve's point. I wound up, I was working in state government for Governor Pat Lucey at the time and coordinated the state's response to the Exxon mine up in the Wolf River drainage, and had worked at developing non-metallic and metallic mining legislation over the years. This is not a freshly discovered deposit. We've known there's taconite up there in the Pinokies. It's a question of grade and economics, and earlier developers, not so many years ago, looked at the prospects for this GTAC site and decided it was uneconomic. The current corporations that are involved in developing that obviously have a different view. Regardless of that, this is not a base metal deposit with cyanide leaching and sulfides. It's taconite, and of course we know what the taconite tailings did in terms of threatening the clarity and the ecological health of Lake Superior. But we also have in Black River an example of the only reclaimed taconite mine in Wisconsin, which has been, as far as I can determine, a reasonable reclamation. But this mine does pose a threat not just to the National Park and Lake Superior environment, but to a host of cold water tributaries and other streams and watersheds up there. And the last thing we ought to be doing is fast-tracking legislation that undercuts our environmental regulations, public review, making sure we've got the right scientific information, that we have a full dialogue on the short and long-term benefits and cost of making this decision. And for that reason, I think we should be very suspicious of legislation that doesn't allow careful consideration when we're talking about resources of the importance of Apostle Islands and Lake Superior.
Steve, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go to Dan in Fitchburg next. Dan, hello to you.
Hello. I'd like to share three comments. First of all, I have paddled some of the wild and scenic rivers, and I've also paddled a canoe in Lake Superior in the Apostle Islands, and just wanted to thank you folks and Bud and all the people that helped to preserve those very important landscapes. The other thing I'd like to say is that I think there's a wonderful balance between the recreational opportunities, the cultural preservation, and the biological preservation in those areas. So I think it's just a wonderful project in those ways.
Thank you for calling. Annie, any comment?
No, I agree. I have a feeling that at some point in the near future, somebody is going to clue in to the extent that Bud was involved in many of the things in Wisconsin, environmentally and conservationally speaking. And really, there ought to be more work done on some of that. There's a huge political story waiting to be told in Bud's papers, which I believe ended up in the Wisconsin State Historical Society archives. And at some point, Bud may start ranking up there as a conservationist with other noted people, you know, Alda Leopold. I could see in 30 years people will start to talk about what Bud did in terms of political conservation to what Leopold did in terms of philosophical conservation. He was pretty critical to a lot of those areas that I have great fond memories of in Wisconsin.
Thanks again, Dan, for calling. I want to give Andy and Eau Claire a chance. Andy, hello to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Right after I called, you guys started to touch on the stuff with Red Cliff and Bad River.
Yeah.
And that's really what I wanted to bring up, but I just wanted to mention that I had talked to some elders at Red Cliff, and they definitely, you know, see this as a negative thing. They just view it as, you know, the government had been trying to go around treaty rights for a long time to take back Ojibwe lands, and the whole thing with Gaylord Nelson and the national parks was just a way of going around the law so that they could just take the land without having to intervene with Congress. And they just see it as, you know, how they eventually found a legal way to steal the land, but, you know, for the U.S. government to steal the land from them.
Well, let's get a comment from Annie. Annie?
It's a tricky thing. I'm well aware. I haven't dealt with Bad River or Red Cliff in some time, but I was I have very interesting memories of going out and talking to them in the 80s when we were working on planning
the visitor center and getting their input. And there are a lot of bad feelings up there. I don't know if they, it doesn't sound like they have died, but I know there are a lot of bad feelings that went on up there as to what happened. And one can't discount that. I think part and parcel of it is simply the history of indigenous peoples in North America and how they were dealt with. I don't necessarily agree, and this isn't partisan politics on my part because I worked for Bud. I don't think that Gaylord and Bud and everybody always made the best choice, but this is 50-50 hindsight. And when I look at it, and I do a lot of work with indigenous peoples up here in Canada, and I did a fair amount of work in Wisconsin as well, sometimes you just have to look at the history and understand that what went on is part and parcel of history, and not everybody's going to agree with it. I think insofar as they could, there was some very sound efforts to try and engage the indigenous people. Let me reiterate what we said at the beginning, the impetus for this national park actually started with a tribal council resolution from Bad River Tribal Council. They said, we want this national park. We think it would help protect a lot of the areas that we're not going to get protected otherwise. We already have squatters in the sloughs. We already have problems with motorboats and people coming in and doing things that we disagree with. I think there was some real potential there. And just after, shortly after the Apostle Islands had gone through Congress, there were a number of other indigenous groups, the Crow out in Montana, for example, who did come together and actually create reasonable working arrangements on national parks in their region. There was a real effort to try and, I think, offer opportunities for more collaborative work with it. Were they what the indigenous people wanted? Well, not at the time, but sometimes that is what happens. Were Gaylord and Bud out to steal land? I don't really think so. If you want to steal land from indigenous peoples, national parks are kind of an iffy way to do it. That's certainly what happened in Yellowstone, but I don't think the Apostle Islands is really an effort to go out and take lands. In fact, there was a real interest in ensuring that Bad River and Red Cliff actually got back some of the land that had been alienated from the reserve proper during the allotment process, which is a, you know, interesting shell game that the federal government did. Are people happy? No, some of them really aren't. And you can't, I just think that's an unfortunate fact of history in many ways, and a lot of problems I've discovered in the 20 years I've worked with indigenous peoples. A lot of modern problems actually have their roots back 200, 300 years ago.
Yeah.
And they're very hard to overcome. They really are, all good intentions aside.
I enjoyed reading the book, but you have a reflections chapter at the end that talks a bit about where are we now and what's happening now there. There were some questions and issues that were raised as arguments against the park that have proven not to be the case. One argument was, well, this is going to be a place for rich people to go. And you had some interesting data there to share, Annie.
Yes. We used that for a couple of things. One was for Bud to really go back and think about the lessons of being involved in creating something like a national park. And one was to really look at where the park was, 40 years later, 30 years later, on it. And I really have to thank the superintendents of the Apostle Islands who really helped out in developing that particular sections in terms of data. You know, my reaction was, and there was a time when I was a history major, although I moved on from it, is, you know, history is great at 2020 hindsight. And, you know, what people thought would happen in the 1960s when they were working on this, our predictive powers really aren't always that good. They didn't look ahead. They didn't have a magic vision and say, ooh, scuba diving to wrecks is going to be, you know, a significant thing, and maybe we should protect the lake bottom and those wrecks. Kind of thing. People evolve in their recreational habits in ways that are completely unanticipated. So to back in the 60s, nobody really worried about the impacts of climate change and what that would mean to the drawing down of the lakeshore and portions of land not literally being in park boundaries, now being exposed and subject to interesting actions. But there was some real fears that this would be a rich person's, you know, people with million-dollar sailboats could come out, but it wouldn't be, you know, the working person's kind of thing. And that isn't really true. You look at the statistics of who uses it, and I will say they seem to be an educated bunch. It amazed me that most of the people coming out there had at least grade 12 or an undergraduate degree when they were coming out there, which I can't really explain. But, you know, the economic levels, this isn't a rich person's paradise. Now, some of the things that came in, including water taxis and ferries to different islands so that people could go out without necessarily owning a boat, were pretty important to ensuring that you know, the rank and file could get out and experience some of this. I think it's been thoughtful development on the part of superintendents through the years that has ensured that there are opportunities for people without boats. Is it as well used and accessible as they thought it would be? No, it isn't the Grand Canyon. It isn't Yellowstone, but it is attracting.
It's a regional attraction, I think, as you put it.
Yeah, it is. Well, it was thought that a huge number of people would come out of the Midwest for it. It's kind of the Midwest's playground. That is true. But they're getting people from a lot of different areas. So I think particularly as that the reputation of those parks grow and are promoted, then the Apostles may welcome into its own.
Yeah. Steve, in the last minute here, how well does the Lakeshore serve as Bud's legacy, and what else do we have to thank him for? You never get this done in a minute, but...
I would never even try in a minute, Larry, but it's one of the many, many touchstones in conservation. I think if you look back and try to reflect upon what did Bud do over a lifetime of work here in conservation, you can point to an array of public lands and public access at almost every scale, from the most local to things that were regional and national attractions. He had a lifelong commitment to public education, which he translated into a commitment to citizen engagement and participation in decision-making, and he was just locked in on that as a principal. Thirdly, he played a tremendous role. I think it will become more important as time goes on, in the founding and development of nonprofit organizations like Gathering Waters, the Land Conservancy mm-hmm. statewide organization, or Thousand Friends of Wisconsin, and other kinds of groups, building the civic capacity of the state. And lastly, I'd have to say that just generation of students who have emerged as scholars like Annie, conservation yeah. leaders, activists, that will be an enduring legacy.
Well, with that, we have to conclude. I want to thank you both very much. Annie Booth, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And Steve Bourne, thank you as well. Good. And we'll probably see you. I'm sure I'll see you again.
Probably on a trout stream, Larry.
Probably on a trout stream. Annie Booth is co-author of Environmental Politics and the Creation of a Dream, Establishing the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. She's co-author with Bud Jordahl, who passed away, Harold Jordahl. I don't think everybody called him Bud. I don't think anybody ever called him Harold. Maybe his wife at one point, once you'd get irritated with him or something. Bud Jordahl and Annie Booth, the authors, and Steve Bourne, Professor Emeritus of Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Well, certainly the Apostle Islands are a great treasure. The Apostle Islands National Lakeshore is, I think, a great treasure. Another treasure that we have in this state is Devil's Lake, Devil's Lake State Park. How did it come to be where it is today? Well, a big part of it had to do with the CCC. You know what that stands for? That's Civilian Conservation Corps. Bob Moore has a book out on it. It's called Devil's Lake, Wisconsin and the Civilian Conservation Corps. And that's coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.